Welcome to Wings of Inspired Business with your host and entrepreneur, Melinda Wittstock, along with her guests as they help up-and-coming female entrepreneurs manifest confidence, connections, and capital to exceed their wildest dreams in business and in life. Here she is, Melinda Wittstock.
Hello, welcome to Wings Sheroes. I'm Melinda Wittstock, and so glad you're here and ready to take flight with me. Today, well, this might sound a bit like a riddle, but we're talking about VCs, a vagipreneur, and a $100 bill, and what it takes to innovate on the frontier of female sexual health, from startup to exit. Raising money from a bunch of dudes in Silicon Valley is hard enough for most female entrepreneurs, without having to talk about arousal, menstruation, or fertility. Today we meet Rachel Braun Sherrill. She calls herself the Vagipreneur, and we'll be hearing how she got investor buy-in for her company Sempre, makers of Zestra essential arousal oils. She sold the company and now helps other women innovate in femtech. Ready? Let's fly.
Welcome to Wings, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, vagipreneur, that is an awesome term. So awesome, in fact. You trademarked it.
Yes, I did.
What is a vagipreneur?
A vagipreneur is a person in the business of female sexual health. And the distinction there is I don't deliver care, although people think that I have a lot of information. And I do have a lot of information, but I would still go to your doctor instead of me. It really is to focus on the business of building companies in female sexual health, female reproductive health, and female wellness. So purely from, don't ask me where your aches and pains are. I might be able to tell you why your arousal has been declining, but I won't be able to treat it.
And this is a massive growing space in the startup community. And
yes,
and a lot of women running these businesses.
Absolutely. There's this explosion in what they call femtech or sex tech. And there are just dozens of companies that have been created in the last couple of years, with more springing up every day as primarily women, but not only, often with male partners, create companies that resolve particular problems that they themselves experienced and did not see a sufficient solution out there. One of the interesting things that I've learned is often you speak to people in this business and you talk about passion. And sometimes that falsely gets translated into emotion. My experience working in this field, I ran a company that improved arousal, desire, and satisfaction for women. And now working with companies in this field is that the passion is really required, because this is really hard work. Building a business is hard work in any space. Building a business where you're saying words like vagina or satisfaction or incontinence or bladder leakage or menstrual flow, there are some specific challenges that seem to just be increasingly hard in this space. And you need the passion to push through the challenges.
It's so difficult for women, whatever industry they're in, as entrepreneurs, to get the funding that they need. But how does it go in a VC meeting when women are talking about an addressable market that, frankly, most of the men who are VCs are not going to understand?
Well, it's very interesting. My experience, and we raised money in 2008 when the bottom was falling out of the financial markets. And we go, when I say we, my business partner of 20 years and I, go into meetings. Now we've successfully run our own businesses together for decades. So we're unfortunately seen as first-time entrepreneurs because we've never raised capital before, even though we have a track record. And we're women and we're talking about vaginas. So, and that's probably the
heart of
the story.
Does the male brain just sort of shut down the minute they hear like vagina?
And then I think the male brain immediately reverts to being in a seventh grade locker room. It's really
right?
been more of my experience. No insult intended to the actual seventh graders who find that they're probably more mature than this. But in our particular case, we were going in talking about arousal, desire, and satisfaction. And this, in all the categories I've worked in, and I've worked with women on businesses and products that affected them from the tops of their heads to the tips of their toes, the benign hair care, skin care, the more serious psoriasis, infertility, menstruation, the ones that are not so exciting, like foot fungus and hemorrhoids. And what's interesting is, in, at least in the world of arousal, this is the one category I've ever found where women don't really talk to their friends about this. And I'm not talking about college age women, because every time I have this conversation, they say, well, we're talking about it. Our target was women 35 plus in committed relationships who had noticed that something had changed in their response, in their feeling, in their desire. So this is one of the few categories where they're not talking to their cousins. They're not talking to their sisters. They're not talking to their friends. Only 3 to 5% of obstetricians and gynecologists would bring this up. What do they, they'll talk about sexual health. They'll talk about disease. They'll talk about infertility. They'll talk about birth control, but they rarely start conversations where, you know, how are you enjoying your sex life? Is it satisfying?
So part of what you're doing is making it okay for women to talk about this, but also for the market to, I mean, it's a massive addressable market, but you don't know it's a massive addressable market if people aren't talking about
it. Well, thankfully, there are a number of brilliant entrepreneurs who are starting businesses in various parts of female health and trying, as I say, to make the world safe, to talk about menstruation, to talk about infertility, to talk about arousal. So there are a lot of people now on this team, but it is an uphill battle to make people comfortable. And when you think about being a person going into the somewhat daunting environment where you're the entrepreneur facing a, what looks like a sea of venture capitalists, you know, you don't need another hurdle that they're uncomfortable with the category or that they don't know the language. And we had some amazing experiences doing this. So we had, over a period of 2 days, 13 meetings with different venture capital funds in Silicon Valley. And for those people who have never been there, in my first experience of raising money, although I was...
So you were going up and down the Sand Hill Road?
You're going, not even. You don't even have to get back in your car. There are 13 offices, one next to the other, who look relatively identical to you.
And they all talk to each other too.
They all believe they have very distinct investment theses, but after two or three, they start to blend. So we walk into our first meeting, and the first question we get, which was relatively predictable, was, how is this product different than Viagra? And the product for our company was a patented blend of botanical oils and extracts that is clinically proven to increase arousal, desire, and satisfaction for women of all ages and life stages. It's a mouthful, but it's topically applied, so it's not systemic. That's the first difference. You can use it on demand, as you can some of the erectile dysfunction drugs. So taking ourselves very seriously as business people, we answered the question and we said, well, Viagra basically works as a vasodilator, which means it increases blood flow. And given that the male sexual response system is like a hydraulic pump, when you pump blood in, the system works, everybody's good. We heard crickets basically, and we saw their eyes start
all,
to glaze
like,
over.
At their,
and,
like, feet,
you know,
or...
we knew we had answered the question accurately, but that didn't mean that we got their attention. Okay, strike one. We go into the next meeting, and the question is, we saw that your clinical research said that it increased satisfaction. What does it do for the man? To which we said, well, the clinical research, the 13-site peer-reviewed placebo-controlled double-blind study was really focused on her satisfaction. And anecdotally, we believe that when his satisfaction was reported to be higher, it was likely a result of two things. It was either his enjoyment at her increased satisfaction or perhaps increasing confidence that he was a more skilled partner, but it wasn't specifically focused on his satisfaction. You know, again, you could hear yourself, you know, you could hear your neurons firing. It was so quiet. So after the second meeting, we now have 11 more. And I turned to Mary and I said, we're not going to raise any money with this approach. Will you just sort of unleash me, which is always a scary thing to do, and let me try something different? She said, okay. And I said, if it doesn't work, we'll go back. We'll come up with a third strategy. So I go into the third meeting and I'm a person, I think you'll see why this is relevant, who only carries credit cards. I don't ever have cash. I track everything. My spreadsheets have spreadsheets, and I just find it's easier. But on this particular day, I call it divine intervention. I looked in my wallet and I happened to have a $100 bill. So I walk into the meeting with my $100 bill and I slam it on the table, sort of for dramatic effect. And I say, here's a $100 bill. Because I figure these folks are gamblers at heart. And I say, if anyone asks me a question that I can't answer, or makes a sexual innuendo that I haven't heard before, or a double entendre that makes me blush or makes me uncomfortable in any way, this $100 is yours. And then I pause, which also isn't my best thing. And I say, she likes it more. She wants to have it more. Let's talk about the business model. And in that moment, it wasn't as if they didn't take me seriously or thought I was less or more intelligent than they had in the first two meetings. But I'd sort of laid down the gauntlet and said, you know, we're not embarrassable. We're here to talk about a business.
You got that all out of the way and straight to the thing that they were comfortable talking about. What's the size of your market? What's your competition? How am I going to, as the VC, going to make money?
Right. Which is all they care about.
That's all they care
about. But I never got to that. And I'm sure a lot of women, I know a lot of women, especially the ones that I've worked with and I've had the pleasure of interviewing, have an experience where they never get to what are the market challenges? Who are the competitors? Tell me about your background as a team.
Well, as founders, we get so wrapped up in our own products, you know, and like, here's how it works. And like, I was doing some advising for a bunch of startups associated with Tony Hsieh, the founder of Zappos, mm-hmm. and his downtown project in Las Vegas. And folks would come on the phone and we'd have a half an hour and they'd say, hey, so my product does this and it does that. It does this. It does that. It does that. And I'd say, hey, that's great. So how can I help you? And they'd say, and my product, it does this. It does that. It does this. It does that. And I'd be like, that's awesome. How can I help you? And we'd get towards the end and it's like, do you have any customers? Like, who right. are your customers? And because that's where I could help. And so often I think we just get wrapped up in that. And because going back to what you were saying about passion, we're passionate about what we're creating. But in a funding meeting, it's how is everybody going to make money? How's everybody going to get 10x their investment?
Yeah, what is this, you know, what have you done for me lately kind of thing? And given that a lot of my experience, I started at J&J, at Johnson & Johnson, building businesses and have worked for 20 plus years. Building brands and businesses in consumer products, pharmaceuticals, health and wellness, I start with two things. What is the problem that you're solving? So that's number one, and we can talk about that in a little bit more detail. And what insight are you going to catalyze or connect with that's going to have the consumer, doctor, patient, whoever is the buyer, whoever is going to engage in the financial transaction to say, this is something that I need. This is going to replace something I'm already doing, or I'm going to solve a problem that I don't currently solve. You know, when I'm speaking to students, undergrads and business students, I often use an example, let's say like Warby Parker. So it wasn't as if before Warby Parker, people could not get glasses. People got glasses. They were expensive. It was time consuming. There were a number of steps in the process that were challenging, but it wasn't as if there was this empty, vast wasteland where people could not get glasses. What Warby Parker did from my perspective is they said, let's figure out what's not working about this and how to get people things that they want, which we have never before offered in this space, which is convenience, which is selection, which is ease, which is personalization.
Yeah, and tying it to this wonderful Give Forward mission as well.
And also tying it to an entirely different business model and distribution model. So oftentimes we get so excited about the product and service, and I think it's entrepreneurs. I don't think this is specific to men and women. And you have to put yourselves in the shoes of the buyer. So in the case of funding, it's an investor, a venture capitalist, an angel. What is this going to do for them? How are you going to help make them money? And you better be offering something that you can demonstrate that there's a commercial financial model and business upon which they'll get a return. The other piece in funding that you hear about so much, even more so now, I mean, we've had this tidal wave of stories about the incongruity and the disparity in terms of access to fundraising, in terms of the number of female investors, you know, followed closely on the heels of, with an explosion of all these things that are happening with the Harvey Weinstein stories of the world. So everybody's clear that it's not equal and it's probably not even fair. From a business perspective and a fundraising perspective, you still have to find a way to make your story meaningful. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that the current playing field is fair or right, but I am saying when you're going in to raise money and you have all these things stacked against you, you still do have to figure out a way to tell your story, about your product, your solution, and how you're going to make money for the person who's sitting across the table from you.
Yeah. And it comes down to that empathy of just understanding that how men and VCs in particular are going to be hearing you is different. And so taking the time to actually make it relevant to the other person is a critical skill. What do you think has to change for women to get more funding? I mean, I think there's some areas where it is sort of external. We don't fit the pattern because they invest in their kind of pattern recognition. So they're looking for a dude in a hoodie who's dropped out of MIT, Stanford or Harvard, has a garage, you know, all that ramen noodle thing, right? And we don't fit, there's too many carbs in ramen. We don't fit that pattern. So there are some things that we can't control, but of the things that we can control where the power truly is, what advice do you give women that, you know, apart from like, yeah, like understanding, talking about the numbers, talking about the business, what are some of the ways that we limit ourselves or get in our own way? And what's some advice about how not to get into our own way and get access to that capital we need to really, you know, like execute on our moonshots?
Often it's easier said than done. And obviously some of the big solutions that are not controllable by one person is to have more female investors. It's to have more female entrepreneurs to control more of the money.
Yeah, we need more exits among us, and then we can write checks to each other, right?
So that's a whole big movement and trend that will take, you know, will take a village to move. But as an individual entrepreneur going into an individual investment meeting, you had referred to, you have to know your numbers. That is not insignificant. That is paramount. You should know your business better than anybody else. You should be prepared. You should plan and identify what are the 10 questions they're likely to ask and what are my answers. And if I don't like the way they sound, I'm practicing them in front of a mirror. I'm practicing them on video. I'm playing them back. There's no, let's just wing it and see how it goes. In my experience, preparation is a big help in terms of being relaxed. And I don't mean to say that it's simple. There are plenty of people who, as they say, would rather die than speak publicly. But if you go in as a professional, and ultimately your job in that meeting is as a salesperson, how can I sell them on the marketplace? How can I sell them on the story? How can I sell them on the solution? And how can I sell them on myself and the rest of the leadership team?
Oh, yeah, because they invest in people.
And if they're already uncomfortable, so if you come in with female health and you happen to be a woman, you know from the statistics, you're already starting from a deficit. So it's up to you as the entrepreneur to figure out a way, how do I get the conversation around to the actual topic I want to talk about? How do I remove the elephants from the room and say, let's just talk about this? Which is why I think in retrospect that the idea of saying she likes it more, she wants to talk about it more worked, because there's obviously this heightened sense of, are we going to be talking about sex? Are we going to be talking about, you know, individuals? And I also, in my case, find that humor is a very effective tool. So one of the examples that I would give to change the energy in the room was, I would say, you know, one of the reasons people don't talk about this is because if you and I are talking about this, it's likely that we're friends. You don't talk about this often to strangers. So I could say to you, you know, listen, my husband used to do this trick where he'd hang from the chandelier and do this crazy great thing. And I love it. I loved it, but he doesn't do it anymore. And the next night we're out to dinner, I've now put my partner in an uncomfortable situation, either knowingly or unknowingly. So I often would tell off-color stories, not personal ones, but hypotheticals, or I would go into meetings and say, just a show of hands, you know, whether I'm speaking to students or investors, for everybody in the room, raise your hand and raise it high. How many of you are looking for partners with 4-hour erections? You know, and it goes right to the heart of, this is language they've been hearing on everywhere and during the Super Bowl, on every network, on every radio station for years. And it's something that they've sort of absorbed. And one of the things that I find in working in this space is that the language around erectile dysfunction and the solutions, bigger, longer, stronger, 4 hours, that doesn't translate for the majority of women who do not think of intimacy as a performance activity. So even calling attention to that and shining a light on that, and even saying the language we're going to talk about is different because the problem we're trying to solve is different and the consumer we're trying to sell to is different, you know, that starts. I'm a big believer of going right to the heart of the thing that is on everyone's mind that no one wants to say. And I found that helps you get to the actual business.
More from our Super Shiro guest in a moment. First, I want to share with you Springboard Enterprises, one of our sponsors at Wings. Springboard is an accelerator and network for female-founded technology businesses. It's helped me and 684 other female entrepreneurs grow, fund, and scale their businesses. So far, $7.9 billion in capital raised, 160 exits, 13 IPOs. Learn about the Springboard Dolphin Tank and its accelerators for media tech and life sciences. If your business qualifies, apply. It will change your life. That's Springboard Enterprises at sb.co. We talk a lot about leveraging our authentic feminine power, because when we're being authentic, we connect more deeply with our customers, our team, our investors, our vendors. That's why I'm sharing my company Verifeed's innovative social media strategy for you Shiros who want to grow your true tribe of influential customers. It's called Return on Authenticity, your ROA, because we know from the millions of social media conversations our technology analyzes that there's a growing, measurable, and predictable return that comes from genuinely engaging on social media. So, if you're highly motivated and mission-driven and you want to ignite your business growth and brand buzz, I've got a special offer that you can check out right now. Go to verifeed.com/wings. That's verifeed.com/wings for your return on authenticity. As business owners, we're so focused on revenue and earnings that we can often overlook what's driving the value of our company. Zero Limits Ventures supports female entrepreneurs like me. And ZLV is offering Wings listeners its valuation growth playbook and a complimentary one-hour consultation. Check it out, zerolimitsventures.com/access, to understand your valuation and capital acquisition strategy. That's zerolimitsventures.com/access. And we're back with Rachel Braun Schurl, the vagipreneur and entrepreneur in femtech.
So as co-founder of Sempre, and am I pronouncing this right? You guys did Zestra.
Yes.
And then you had an exit. You sold it. And Zestra, for folks out there, you may know it as essential arousal oils. Mm-hmm. And it's the only patented topically applied product. And you were referring to it earlier. What was it like going through an exit? There's so many, I know a lot of women who've had exits, or like either like an exit, a very profitable one, or one where it's a massive pivot, or one where it's the worst. It's where you just have to say, okay, this isn't working. I'm going to go on to my next one. Mm-hmm. There are lots of different ways to have an exit. What was it like emotionally going through that process?
It's interesting. I had started my career working on brands. So I found this incredible sense of ownership. And then I had a long career in consulting, which I'm back to now. And you learned that you could provide what you thought were great solutions, great strategies, great marketing plans, but you had no control over whether they were actually executed and how well they were executed. So I started learning to make it a little less personal. And for some reason, probably because I had a lot of conversations with VCs prior to doing this, is I was very clear that this business was mine to get to a point where someone could make money from it, or people could make money from it. That being said, that's all very philosophical.
Well, some people really are the startup people, and other people are more the kind of engine, take it to scale or beyond. You know, actually knowing who you are is vital in this. Not everybody is going to run the whole journey.
Well, I didn't know I was an entrepreneur, certainly when I started my career. And the one common fact is I kept going to smaller and smaller organizations. So I started at J&J, and then I went to a consultancy that serviced J&J, and then I started my own business, and then I raised venture capital. So I don't know that I certainly didn't come out of college or business school thinking that I was an entrepreneur. What I think of myself as is a problem solver. And the harder it is, the more motivating it is to me. So going back to your original question, is you become so passionate, you become so invested, you become so knowledgeable. And I would say someone said something in a meeting that made it possible for me to separate. And we were making a decision about the business. And one of our board members said, "This is so hard. This is like deciding between one of your children." And I all of a sudden I realized, that's a really hard decision. I have two kids. That I could never do. This I could do. Mm-hmm. So it sort of put it in perspective. I'm not saying it's not hard and it's not painful and you don't have, you know, second thoughts and seller's remorse and buyer's remorse and everything else. But I think you focus on what you did and what you learned and what you could have done better. So in our case, when the board was orchestrating the exit, it was very clear how difficult it was to build this category in the US with our moral approach or cultural values, however you're going to describe it, that makes it difficult for people to talk about this. Culture and religion and politics and everything else. The company that Zestra was sold to had a specialty in creating international distribution relationships. And in many parts of the world, this product and this category and this topic is a lot easier. So that was the strategic intent. And they've since opened distribution in 30 plus markets in places that I think there's less pushback.
It's interesting what you mentioned, though, about where we get caught up personally and not taking things personally. I think sometimes women, we're so focused on the relationship that when things go wrong, even things that we can't control, or just the attachment that we have to things. Women sometimes take longer to fire someone that has to be fired, you know, those sorts of things. How can we get out of our own way that way? You know, I've had to, in my career, I've had to learn that. And I think in many cases, you can be attached to something without even being aware consciously that that's what's going on. So to actually literally, like, I don't know whether it's through like practicing mindfulness or meditation or counseling or what, but like trying to separate ourselves from our businesses, our baby in a way, right?
I think there's a couple of specific things. I do think it depends how old you are. You know, often I say, trust your gut, but I would say that to a person who's been working 10 years, not for someone whose ink on their diploma from college is barely dry. So I think you have to trust your gut.
There's not enough life experience to even contextualize your gut at
that
stage.
Very well said. I've always found that when my gut is saying, this isn't a good fit, or that's not the right direction, or this partner's not going to be the way to go, that I'm usually right. And I've been trying to teach myself, you know, over the course of my career to get better at that. The other thing that I do is I constantly speak to other entrepreneurs. I constantly actually listen to podcasts and read books and read articles. And I actually capture things that other people have done that I think are interesting. And I try to store them in my sort of entrepreneurial library so that I could call upon them. I don't think it's easy and I don't think it's natural necessarily always, not just for women, but for men as well. I think you have to really be able to be introspective and critical without cutting yourself to shreds. So oftentimes when I'm talking to female entrepreneurs, they're very good at telling me what they're not good at.
Right.
And I think it's appropriate to know what your weaknesses are, but you shouldn't do it in place of identifying your strengths and what you're good at. And I have a particular skill, I shouldn't say skill, a particular failing that my business partner has pointed out. If I find something easy to do and I'm naturally good at it, I say it's easy. So instead of characterizing it as an asset or a skill or a point of leverage, I say, well, this is easy, so it must not be that important or that hard.
Oh my goodness, I do that too. And I recently am conscious of that because it's actually what it is undervaluing. Like, so something that's easy to you, must not be valuable, but it's actually hugely valuable. Like other people would struggle to have that same superpower.
I love that, the same superpower.
But it's true. And I mean, you know, it's taken me a while to understand this, that I think a lot of women think, especially in the startup stage where you're doing all parts of the process and you think you have to be good at everything, or you think you have to learn the thing that you're naturally not very good at, or you naturally just hate doing. You know what? Hire your weakness. right? Like, admit your weakness and say, okay, so like, I suck at that. Actually, right. I'm really bad at that. Like, I'm in my case, I'm not an operational person. I'm the sort of vision person. That's who I am. So I need my, you know, in the book Rocket Fuel, mm-hmm. you know, you got your integrator. I need that person. Right. Like, that's vital for me. So, but actually understanding that so you can like double down on your strength.
Which is why it's important to know what you're not good at, not to berate yourself, but to find a person or a team that can fill that void that you can't fill. And I do think it's very hard as an entrepreneur to let go. And I've learned from other folks that I've worked with who I consider better at delegating. And you can see how much more mental space you have when you're working on things that you're good at and then that you enjoy. And often those are the same.
Why is delegating so hard for so many women though?
I think it's a sense of I want it done my way or no way.
But the root of that is intriguing to me.
Well, I think certainly for me, when I was raising money, I had such a feeling of personal responsibility that they were investing in me and they were investing in my business partner that I had to make sure it got done right.
Yeah.
But I think as a culture, we're so busy often being busy that we can't take the step that you just said, you know, maybe for you, you know, you're not a good operational person and finding that person. I think it takes a couple of experiences.
Yeah.
To have it really is confidence. It really takes confidence to say you're not good at something or you don't know something.
Yeah. What's dangerous is when you're just good enough. Do you know what I mean? If you're just an overall competent person at anything you do, right? So like you're really smart and you'll figure it, you know, you'll figure it out. You're sort of curious and can do, and you're just good enough to be dangerous, but like, it's not the best
but
use
it is
of your
dangerous.
Time. It's actually dangerous because it deflects you from the thing where if you're building a business, you're about creating value. So you're going to create more value or more leverage. It's really about leverage, right? Leveraging your strengths and understanding that. And I think a lot of guys just get that.
Well, you've heard the adage that when men apply for a promotion, they maybe have 10% of the skills. And when women apply, they're already doing the job and they have 90% of the skills, which says a couple of things. It means we evaluate ourselves differently as women, and it means we throw our hat in the ring much later than our competitors are. So a lot of the opportunities are not necessarily available to us. And I also think that how you approach things, my father, who passed away about a year and a half ago, who was just an extraordinary man. Whenever you have an essay, who influenced you the most or who do you model yourselves after? For me, there's so much about what he did that I often go back and say, you know, WWGD, we called him Grampy. What would Grampy do in terms of how we would deal with a situation? Because he had such a strict, unbendable moral code. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I learned in business, big surprise, is that I can't work with people who lie. And I found myself in business with people who lie. I can't work with people who cheat. And I found myself in business with people who cheat. And so my mantra has been, I do work I like with people I like. And if one of them has to fail, I'd rather it be the work I don't like with people I do like, because otherwise there's no hope. I mean, particular example of how, when you realize that you're working with people who don't look at things the same way, we had made this big investment to work with this partner. And we had worked on a contract and we had hammered out every detail and put in every control that we had to protect ourselves. And I launched the partnership and spent a couple of days with this person, came back to my board, and I said, this isn't going to work. I know what we put on paper describes a partnership. This person doesn't understand what that means. And I think we should get out as quickly as we can. And the answer to me was, well, Rachel, you supported this. You thought it was a good idea. Meaning, you know, if you're so smart or we should trust you, how come you're changing your mind? And I said, I have new information now. So now I'm making a different decision. But even in that moment, my instincts and my experience interacting with this partner were to a certain extent invalidated. But I said, I'm a big believer that an intelligent person says what they don't know and declares when they learn something. And I think that's a very different perspective, not for all women, but for a lot of women. I spend time figuring out where I went wrong and what I did right. If you're not doing the first part, you probably save a lot of time and emotional energy.
Yeah, that's so evolved. I mean, learning actually just to even just accept ourselves and accept our faults, just love, you know, our value ourselves, love ourselves, like that kind of, I guess, radical acceptance. A lot of the work, just even from the Brené Brown TED mm-hmm. Talk and how revolutionary that was. Actually, a book I read recently, Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach, mm-hmm. an amazing, amazing book. I think when we do that, we start to understand our own value. What's funny to me about entrepreneurship is it's probably the best therapy that you could ever go through.
Or the greatest feeder for therapy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's that too, but it challenges you in so many different ways.
It sort of causes you to look very honestly, all the protections are revealed. Yeah.
If you want to succeed, yes.
And people are very quick to tell you when you're doing something wrong.
Absolutely. But it forces you to really, I mean, I think the most conscious leaders that I've experienced, people doing really amazing things in business, whether I've had the privilege to kind of, hang around with Richard Branson or Necker Island and folks like that, or meet Sarah Blakely from Spanx, they all have this much more enlightened, kind of like almost a jokey self-acceptance. But they also have interesting routines, you know, whether it's just business as fun, like it should be fun, or meditation or mindfulness or all these sorts of things. What's your routine? What's your place of sanity that you go in all the kind of maelstrom of this?
So I always tell entrepreneurs, you need to have this place, the place where you wind down. And I should be doing meditation and practicing mindfulness. And anybody who meets me says that I should be doing that. And I probably should. But for me, there are a couple of rituals that I really love, and they're not so crazy and interesting. I work out a lot. I have a couple of rituals with my family that I like to do every day. And when I really need to shut off my mind, which is how I regroup, I watch any one-hour drama that's on any channel under the sun and any comedy. So if I'm really feeling stretched to the wall, a good 20 minutes of Wedding Crashers would sort of get me back in the groove. And I find that I use these quotes and things from books and movies all the time. One of the people who worked with me and when we were working with Zestra said, you know, your style of leadership is movie quoting. So, you know, that works. I mean, there's a scene from Airplane, which is a classic movie, which I maybe watched 10,000 times with my dad, where every time something goes wrong, they said, you know, I guess I've picked the wrong day to give up, whatever.
Yeah, right.
You know, some days and I don't mean any disrespect for people who are actually struggling with this kind of behavior. Some days I picked up the wrong day to give up sniffing glue. You know, when you really need a sense of humor, you really need patience. And for me, laughter and however I get at that is really important. And much more recently, over the past 7 or 8 years, it's been writing. I find that very cathartic. I find it very relaxing. I could be writing, typing on my computer and crying, or laughing to myself by myself. And as my kids would say, you know, Mom, you enough, like you shouldn't crack yourself up that much, make yourself laugh that much. But I find those are just a couple of things that I do regularly. So mine isn't, you know, get up, meditate for 6 hours, you know, have a green drink, all of which is great. Those don't happen to be part of my rituals. But if I don't work out, if I don't laugh, if I don't turn my mind off at some point, either through exercise or being in someone else's fictitious life on Grey's Anatomy, I find that I struggle a lot more to manage the stress.
It's important to just be authentic to yourself. And there's no one routine. It's just like that you have one, you know, is so important. I can't wait to read your book. When is that going to be out?
Our goal is January of 2018.
Oh, fantastic. So that's coming up soon. So I will keep all listeners apprised of when Rachel's book comes out. And I want to thank you for joining us on Wings of Inspired Business today.
Well, thank you. It's delightful to be with you. And I really enjoy speaking with you. And I obviously love speaking about sexual health. So thanks for the opportunity.
This show is recorded in the Mouth Media Network studios in New York City, powered by Sennheiser, the future of audio.
That's it for today's episode. Head on over to wingspodcast.com and subscribe to the show. When you subscribe, you'll instantly get Melinda's special gift, the Wings Success Formula. Women, innovating, networking, growing, scaling is the Wings of Inspired Business Formula for daily success in your business and life. And when you subscribe to the show and post a review to iTunes, you'll be entered into a drawing to win a once-in-a-lifetime VIP Wings opportunity to mastermind in person with Melinda Wittstock in Washington, D.C. That's wingspodcast.com. Be sure to join the growing Wings community on Facebook at Wings Podcast, where Melinda and leading female entrepreneurs share stories, inspirations, challenges, tips, and more. That's facebook.com/wingspodcast. And follow Melinda on Twitter at Melinda Wings. There you can ask questions of Melinda's guests and nominate the super sheroes you want interviewed. That's Twitter at Melinda Wings.